order unspent. My mother worked on and off, primarily as a costurera, or cleaning homes, or taking care of other people's children. We sometimes went with her to the houses she cleaned. They were nice American white people homes. I remember one had a swimming pool, a fireplace, and a thing called rugs. As Mama swept and scrubbed and vacuumed, we played in the corner, my sisters and I, afraid to touch anything. The odor of these houses was different, full of fragrances sweet and nauseating. On 105th Street, the smells were of fried lard, of beans and car fumes, of factory smoke and homemade brew out of backyard stills. There were chicken smells and goat smells and grassless yards filled with engine parts and wire and wood planks cracked and sprinkled with rusty nails. These were the familiar aromas, the funky earth, animal, and mechanical smells which were absent from the homes my mother cleaned. Mama always seemed to be sick. For one thing, she was overweight and suffered from a form of diabetes. She had thyroid problems, bad nerves, and high blood pressure. She was still young then in Watts, in her 30s, but she had all these ailments. She didn't even have teeth. They rotted away many years before. This made her look much older until later when she finally obtained false ones. Despite this, she worked all the time, chased after my brother with a belt or a board, and held up the family when almost everything else came apart. Heavy blue veins streak across my mother's legs, some of them bunched up into dark lumps at her ankles. Mama periodically bleeds them to relieve the pain. She carefully cuts the engorged veins with a razor and drains them into a porcelain-like metal pail called a tina. I'm small, and all I remember are dreams of blood. Me drowning in a Red Sea. Blood on sheets on the walls, splashing against the white pail in streams out of my mother's ankle. But they aren't dreams. It is Mama bleeding into day and tonight, bleeding a birth of memory, my mother, my blood, by the side of the bed, me on the covers, and her slicing into a black vein and filling the pail into some dark, forbidden, red nightmare, which never stops coming, never stops pouring, this memory of Mama and blood and Watts. One day, my mother asked Ronald and me to go to the grocery store. We decided to go across the railroad tracks into Southgate. In those days, Southgate was an Anglo neighborhood, filled with the families of workers from the auto plant and other nearby industry, like Linwood or Huntington Park. It was forbidden territory for the people of Watts. My brother insisted we go. I don't know what possessed them, but then I never did. It was useless to argue. He'd forced me anyway. He was 9 then, I was 6. So without ceremony, we started over the tracks, climbing over discarded market carts and tore up sofas across Alameda Street into Southgate, all white, all American. We entered the first small corner grocery store we found. Everything was cool at first. We bought some bread, milk, soup, cans, and candy. We each walked out with a bag filled with food. We barely got a few feet, though, when 5 teenagers on bikes approached. We tried not to pay attention and proceeded to our side of the tracks, but the youths pulled up in front of us. While 2 of them stood nearby in their bikes, 3 of them jumped off theirs and walked over to us. "What do we got here?" one of the boys said. "Spicks to order, maybe with some beans." He pushed me to the ground. The grocery splattered onto the asphalt. I felt melted gum and chips of broken beer bottle on my lips and cheek. Then somebody picked me up and held me while the others seized my brother tossed his groceries out and pounded on him. They punched him in the face, in the stomach, then his face again, cutting his lip, causing him to vomit. I remember the shrill, maddening laughter of one of the kids on a bike. This laughing like a raven's wail, a harsh wind's shriek, a laugh that I would hear in countless beatings thereafter. I watched the others take turns on my brother, this terror of a brother, and he doubled over, had blood and spew on his shirt and tears down his face. I wanted to do something, but they held me, and I just looked on, as every strike against Rano opened me up inside. They finally let my brother go, and he slid to the ground, like a rotten banana squeezed out of its peeling. They threw us back over the tracks. In the sunset, I could see the watchtowers, shimmers of 70,000 pieces of broken bottles, seashells, ceramic and metal on spiraling points puncturing the heavens, which reflected back the rays of a falling sun. My brother and I then picked ourselves up, saw the teenagers take off, still laughing, still talking about those stupid greasers who dared to cross over to Southgate. Up until then, my brother had never shown any emotion to me other than disdain. He had never asked me anything, unless it was a demand, an expectation, an obligation to be his throwaway boy doll. But for this once, he looked at me. Tears welled in his eyes. Blood streamed from several cuts, lips and cheeks swollen. "Swear! You got to swear! You'll never tell anybody how I cried," he said. I suppose I did promise. It was his one last thing to hang on to, his rep as someone who could take a belt whipping, who could take a beating in the neighborhood and still go back risking more. It was this pathetic plea from the payment I remember. I must have promised. It was a warm September day when my mother pulled me out of bed, handed me a pair of pants and a shirt, a piece of burnt toast, and dragged me by the arm toward 109th Street School. We approached a huge, dusty brick building with the school's name carved in ancient English lettering across the entrance. Mama hauled me up a row of steps and through two large doors. First day of school. I was 6 years old, never having gone to kindergarten because Mama wanted me to wait until La Pata became old enough to enter school. Mama filled out some papers. A school monitor directed us to a classroom where Mama dropped me off and left to join some parents who gathered in the main hall. The first day of school said a lot about my scholastic life to come. I was taken to a teacher who didn't know what to do with me. She complained about not having any room, about kids who didn't even speak the language. And how was she supposed to teach anything under these conditions? Although I didn't speak English, I understood a large part of what she was saying. I knew I wasn't wanted. She put me in an old creaky chair near the door. As soon as I could, I sneaked out to find my mother. I found Ronald's class with the mentally disabled children instead, and decided to stay there for a while. Actually, it was fun. They treated me like I was everyone's little brother. But the teacher finally told a student to take me to the main hall. After some more paperwork, I was taken to another class. This time, the teacher appeared nicer, but distracted. She got the word about my language problem. "Okay, why don't you sit here in the back of the class," she said. "Play with some blocks until we figure out how to get you more involved." It took her most of that year to figure this out. I just stayed in the back of the class building blocks. It got so every morning I would put my lunch and coat away and walk to my corner where I stayed the whole day long. It forced me to be more withdrawn. It got so bad I didn't even tell anybody when I had to go to the bathroom. I did it in my pants. Soon I stunk back there in the corner and the rest of the kids screamed out a chorus of P.U., resulting in my being sent to the office or back home. In those days, there was no way to integrate the non-English-speaking children, so they just made it a crime to speak anything but English. If a Spanish word sneaked out in the playground, kids were often sent to the office to get swatted or to get detention. Teachers complained that maybe the children were saying bad things about them. An assumption of guilt was enough to get one punished. A day came when I finally built up the courage to tell the teacher I had to go to the bathroom. I didn't quite say all the words, but she got the message and promptly excused me so I didn't do it while I was trying to explain. I ran to the bathroom and peed and felt good about not having that wetness trickle down my pants leg, but suddenly several bells went on and off. I hesitantly stepped out of the bathroom and saw throngs of children leave their classes. I had no idea what was happening. I went to my classroom and it stood empty. I looked into other classrooms and found nothing. Nobody. I didn't know what to do. I really thought everyone had gone home. I didn't bother to look at the playground where the whole school had been assembled for the fire drill. I just went home. It got to be a regular thing there for a while, me coming home early until I learned the ins and outs of school life. Not speaking well makes for such embarrassing moments. I hardly asked questions. I just didn't want to be misunderstood. Many Spanish-speaking kids mangle things up. They would say things like, "where the beer and cantaloupe roam," instead of "where the deer and antelope roam." That's the way it was with me. I mixed up all the words, screwed up all the songs. Eventually, I did make friends. My brother often brought home a one-armed Mexican kid named Jaime. Sometimes we all hung out together. Jaime lost his arm when he was a toddler. Somehow, he managed to get the arm stuck in the wringer of one of those old washing machines which pulled the clothes through two rollers. It tore his arm off at the socket. But later, he made up for it with soccer feet and even won a couple fights with his one good arm. And then there was Earl. I didn't really know him until one day when we lined up following recess, he pulled the trenzas of a Mexican girl in our class named Gabriela. We all liked Gabriela, but she was also quiet, like me. So Earl pulled on her braids, a girl wailed, turned around and saw me standing there. Just then the teacher ran out of the classroom. Gabriela pointed in my direction, the one who never says anything. Because of this, I suffered through an hour's detention, fuming in my seat the whole time. Later that evening, Earl came to my sister's house where we were visiting. Sandy answered the door and looked askance at him. "What do you want?" "I want to know if the boy upstairs can play." "I don't know. I don't think so." "Tell him I got some marbles. If it's okay, I'd like him to play with me." "I don't know. I don't think so." I looked down from the attic window and saw the tall, thin boy in striped shirt and blue jeans. Under an arm was a coffee can. Inside the can, marbles rattled whenever Earl moved. But going through Cindy was becoming a chore. Earl looked past her to a large, round woman in a print dress, my mom. She looked at the boy and then yelled up the stairs in Spanish. "Go and play, Grillos," he said. "You stay in the attic all the time. Go and play. Be like other boys, yeah." Earl waited patiently as the Rodriguez household quaked and quavered trying to get me downstairs and into the yard. Finally, I came down. Earl smiled broadly and offered me the can of marbles. "This is for taking the rap today, man." I looked hard at him, still a little peeved, then reached out for the can and held the best marble collection I had ever seen. I made a friend. Desert winds swept past the TV antennas and peeling fences. Welcome breezes on sweltering, dry summer days when people came out to sit on their porches or beneath a tree in dirt yards, or to fix cars in the street. But on those days, the perils came out too. You could see it in the faces of street warriors, in the play of children, too innocent to know what lurked about, but often the first to fall during a gang war or family scuffle. 103rd Street was particularly hard. It was the main drag in Watts, where most of the businesses were located, and it was usually crowded with people, including dudes who took whatever small change one might have in their pocket. On days like that, Rano, Jaime, Earl, and I ventured out to the third, as 103rd Street was called, or by the factories and railroad tracks playing dirt war with other kids. Other times we played on the rooftop and told stories.
"Did you ever hear the one about the half man?" Earl asked.
"The what?" Jaime replied. "What's a half man?"
"Well, he's a dude who got cut in half at the railroad tracks over there by Docktown."
"Yeah, go on."
"So now he hunts the streets, half of him in one place, the other half in another place. And he eats kids."
"Man, that's sick," Ronald said. "But I got one for you. It's about El Pie."
"What the hell is that?"
"Pie means foot in Spanish, and that's all it is. One big foot walking around." Gusts of wind swirled around the avocado tree branches as the moonlight cast uncanny shadows near where we related our tales.
"And you heard about La Llorona, right?"
Rano continued.
"Oh, yeah, sure. She's an old Mexican lady."
"You mean Mrs. Alvarez?" We laughed. "Nah. This lady once got all her children and cut them up into tiny pieces.
And
then she went all over the neighborhood, sprinkling bits of their bodies everywhere.
And then?
So then God saw what she did and cursed her to walk the world looking for her children, weeping for all eternity. That's why she's called La Llorona, the weeping woman. And you know what? She picks up other kids to make up for the one she's killed." The leaves rustled, giving out an eerie sound. All of us jumped up, including Rano. Before anyone could say goodnight, we stumbled over one another, trying to get out of there, climbed off the roof and ran through bedsheets and dresses hanging on the line, dashing like mad as we made our way home. We changed houses often because of evictions. My dad constantly tried to get better work. He tried so many things. Although he was trained as a teacher, graduated with a degree in biology, and had published Spanish textbooks in Mexico. In Los Angeles, everyone failed to recognize his credentials. In Los Angeles, he was often no more than a laborer. One day, a miracle happened. My dad obtained a substitute teaching job in the San Fernando Valley at Taft High School in Woodland Hills, teaching Spanish to well-off white children. My dad must have thought we had struck oil or something. He bought a house in Reseda. In those days, this made us the only Mexican family around. It was a big house. It had three bedrooms, which meant the boys could have their own room, the girls theirs, and my parents could be alone. It had two baths, a large grassy yard, and an upstanding stucco garage. I went to a school on Shirley Avenue, which actually had books. I remember being chased back home a lot by the Anglo kids. But we were so glad to be in Reseda, so glad to be away from South Central Los Angeles. Even my brother enjoyed success in this new environment. He became the best fighter in the school. All that he went through in Watts finally amounting to something. The big white kids tried to pick on him, and he fought back, hammered their faces with quick hands and street style, after which nobody wanted to mess with him. Soon the bullies stopped chasing me home when they found out I was Jose's brother. My dad went nuts in Reseda. He bought new furniture, a new TV,
and he had the gall to throw away the old black and white box we had in Watts. He bought a new car. He was like a starving man in the candy store, partaking of everything, touching whatever he couldn't eat. He sat on a mountain of debt, but his attitude was, who cares? We were Americans now. We were on our way to having a little bit of that dream. He was even doing it as a teacher, what he was trained for. Oh, what a time it was for my father. My mother, I could tell, was uncomfortable with the whole setup. She shied away from the neighbors. The other mothers around here were good-looking, fit, and well-built. My pudgy mom looked dark, Indian, and foreign, no matter what money could buy. Except she got her false teeth. It seemed Mama was just there to pick up the pieces when my father's house of cards fell. She knew it would. When it happened fast, decisively. It turned out Taft High School hired my father to teach Spanish on a temporary basis. Apparently, the white kids couldn't understand him because of his accent. He wrote letters to the school board proposing new methods of teaching Spanish to American children so he could keep working. They turned them down, and Taft High School let him go. We weren't in Reseda very long, less than a school year. Then the furniture store trucks pulled into the driveway to take back the new sofas, the washing machine, the refrigerator, even the TV. A for sale sign jabbed into the front lawn. The new car had been repossessed. We pulled out of Reseda in an old beat-up Dodge. Sad faces on our neighbors were our farewell. I suppose they realized we weren't so bad for being Mexican. We were going back to an old friend, Pobreza. We moved in with Senny, her husband, and their two daughters. They were then occupying an apartment just outside East Los Angeles. Senny's girls were about the same age as me, my brother and sisters, although we were their uncles and aunts. They also had nicknames. Ana Senny was called Pimples, which doesn't mean anything I know of. But Ronner called her Beanhead, and that took. Aide was called La Banana, because as a child, she had shades of blonde hair. They later had another daughter named Becca, also Huerita. Like most Latinos, we had a mixture of blood. My half-brother Alberto looked Caribbean. His mother came from Veracruz on the Caribbean side of Mexico, which has the touch of Africa. The rest of us had a different shades of Spanish white to Indian brown. Uprooted again, we stuffed our things in a garage. The adults occupied the only two bedrooms. The children slept on makeshift bedding in the living room. My grandmother, Catita, also stayed with us. There were 11 of us crushed into that place. I remember the constant fighting. My dad was dumped on for not finding work. Senny accused her husband of having affairs with other women. Mama often stood outside alone, crying, or in the garage next to all our things piled on top of each other. Rano and I sought refuge in the street. One night, we came home late after having stocked up on licorice and bubblegum. We walked past police cars and an ambulance. Colored lights whirled across the tense faces of neighbors who stood on patches of grass and driveway. I pushed through low voices and entered the house. Blood was spattered on a far wall. Moments before, Senny had been brushing Pimpo's hair when, who knows why, she pulled at the long sections. The girl's screams brought in my sister's husband. An argument ensued, vicious words, accusations. Senny then plucked a fingernail file from the bathroom sink. She flashed it in front of my brother-in-law's face. He grabbed for her hand. The nail file plunged into his arm. Mom and Dad rushed in, ramming my sister against the wall. Nail file crashed steely bright onto the linoleum floor. Soon after the incident, the landlord evicted us all. This was when my mother and father broke up. And so we began that car ride to this train station on the way back to Mexico, leaving L.A., perhaps never to come back. We pull into a parking lot at the Union Station. It's like a point of no return. My father's still making his stand. Mama looks exhausted. We continue to sit in our seats, quiet now, as Dad maneuvers into an empty space. Then we work our way out of the car, straightening our coats, gathering up boxes and taped over paper bags, our luggage. Up to this juncture, it's been like being in a storm. So much instability, of dreams achieved and then shattered, of a silence within the walls of my body, of being turned on, beaten, belittled, and pushed aside, forgotten and unimportant. I have no position on the issue before us. To stay in L.A., to go, what does it matter? I've been a red-hot ball, bouncing around from here to there. Anyone can bounce me. Mama, Dad, Rano, school, streets, I'm a ball. Whatever. We are inside the vast cavern of the station. Pews of swirled wood are filled with people. We sit with our bags near us and string tied from the bags to our wrists so nobody can take them without taking us too. My father turns to us, says a faint goodbye, then begins to walk away. No hugs. He doesn't even look at us. Poncho. The name echoes through the waiting area. Poncho. He turns, stares at my mother. The wet of tears covers her face. Mama then says she can't go. She will stay with him in L.A. I don't think she's happy about this, but what can a single mother of four children do in Mexico? A woman, sick all the time, with factory work for skills in a land where work is mainly with the soil. What good is it except to starve? Está bien, Dad says as he nears my mother. We will make it, mujer. I know it. But we have to be patient. We have to believe. Mama turns to us and announces we are not leaving. I'm just a ball. Bouncing outside, bouncing inside. Whatever. Chapter 2. If you ain't from no barrio, then you ain't born. A 10-year-old boy from South San Gabriel. One evening, dusk came early in South San Gabriel, with wind and cold spinning to earth. People who had been sitting on porches or on metal chairs near fold-up tables, topped with cards and beer bottles, collected their things to go inside. Others put on sweaters or jackets. A storm gathered beyond the trees. Dino and I strolled past the stucco and wood frame homes of the neighborhood, consisting mostly of Mexicans, with a sprinkling of poor white families, usually from Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Texas. Ranchera music did battle with country and western songs as we continued toward the local elementary school and oil and grime-stained basketball under my arm. We stopped in front of a chain-link fence which surrounded the school. An old brick building cast elongated shadows over a basketball court of concrete on the other side of the fence. Leaves and paper swirled in tiny tornadoes. "Let's go over," Tino proposed. I looked up and across the fence. A sign above us read, "No one allowed after 4:30 p.m. by order of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department." Dino turned toward me, shrugged his shoulders, and gave me a "who cares" look. "Help me up, man, then throw the ball over." I cupped my hands and lifted Dino up while the boy scaled the fence, jumped over and landed on sneakered feet. "Come on, Luis, let's go," Dino shouted from the other side. I threw over the basketball, walked back a ways, then ran and jumped on the fence, only to fall back. Although we were both 10 years old, I cut a shorter shadow.
Forget you, man, Dino said. I'm going to play without you.
Wait, I yelled, while walking further back. I crouched low to the ground, then took off, jumped up and placed torn sneakers in the steel mesh. I made it over with a big thud. Wiping the grass and dirt from my pants, I casually walked up to the ball on the ground, picked it up, and continued past Dino towards the courts.
Hey, Dino, what are you waiting for?
The gusts proved no obstacle for a half-court game of b-ball, even as dark clouds smothered the sky. Boy voices interspersed with ball cracking on asphalt. Tino's lanky figure seemed to float across the court as if he had wings under his thin arms. Just then, a black and white squad car cruised down the street. A searchlight sprayed across the schoolyard. The vehicle slowed to a halt. The light shone toward the courts and caught Tino in mid-flight of a layup. The dribbling and laughter stopped.
All right, this is the sheriff's, a voice commanded.
Two deputies stood by the fence, batons and flashlights in hand.
Let's get out of here, Dino responded.
What do you mean, I countered. Why don't we just stay here?
You nuts? We trespassing, man, Dino replied. When they get a hold of us, they're going to beat the crap out of us.
Are you sure?
I know, believe me, I know.
So where do we go? By then, one of the deputies shouted back,
You boys, get over here by the fence now.
But Dino dropped the ball and ran. I heard the deputies yell for Dino to stop. One of them began climbing the fence. I decided to take off too. And never stop this running. We were constant prey, and the hunters soon became big blurs, the police, the gangs, the junkies, the dudes on Garvey Boulevard who took our money, all smudged into one. Sometimes they were teachers who jumped on us Mexicans as if we were born with a hideous stain. We were always afraid, always running. Dino and I raced toward the dark boxes called classrooms. The rooms lay there, hauntingly still, without the voices of children, the commands of irate teachers, or the clapping sounds of books as they were closed. The rooms were empty, forbidden places at night. We scurried around the structures toward a courtyard filled with benches next to the cafeteria building. Dino hopped on a bench, then pulled himself over a high fence. He walked a foot or two on top of it, stopped, and proceeded to climb over to the cafeteria's rooftop. I looked over my shoulder. The deputies weren't far behind, their guns drawn. I grabbed hold of the fence on the side of the cafeteria. I looked up and saw Dino's perspiring face over the roof's edge, his arm extended down toward me. I tried to climb up, my feet dangling. But then a firm hand seized a foot and pulled at it.
They got me, I yelled.
Tino looked below. A deputy spied the boy and called out,
Get down here, you greaser.
Dino straightened up and disappeared. I heard a flood of footsteps on the roof, then a crash. Soon, an awful calm covered us.
Dino! I cried out.
A deputy restrained me as the other one climbed onto the roof. He stopped at a skylight, jagged edges on one of its sides. Shining a flashlight inside the building, the officer spotted Dino's misshapen body on the floor, sprinkled over with shards of glass. After the boarded trip to Mexico, a poverty agency helped our family find a rented place within our means. a square one-bedroom clapboard house on La Presa Street in an unincorporated part of the county called South San Gabriel. The living room served as sleeping quarters for my mom, sisters, and dad. My brother and I had the only bedroom to ourselves, along with piles of stuffed boxes. On hot nights, Rano and I slept outside under the openness of the desert sky. It was similar to Watts, but at least it was a home of our own again. Incorporated towns like Monterey Park, Rosemead, and Montebello surrounded South San Gabriel. The area was located in the San Gabriel Valley, which for years consisted of incipient industry, farmland, and migrant camps, until Los Angeles stretched out fingers of suburban sprawl to the furthest reaches of the valley. There used to be a cornfield not far away from our house on La Presa Street. I remember playing there with my friends. Once, though, a farmer came at us with a loaded shotgun while we swerved and pivoted out of his range through the stalks of corn. By the early 1970s, this area was torn up, and office buildings and parking lots replaced the rows of stalks which once swayed free in the wind, which once held our imaginations afire with war play, clod-throwing contests, and majestic worlds of conquest. By then, with the farmlands and many of the Mexicans of Klingerman Street removed, the city of Rosemead annexed this part of South San Gabriel, and it ceased being unwanted county territory. Unincorporated county territory was generally where the poorest people lived, the old barrios, which for the most part didn't belong to any city because nobody wanted them. Most of Watts and a large section of East Los Angeles were unincorporated county territory. Sometimes they had no sewage system or paved roads. They included hills, ravines, and hollows. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, known as the most brutal of the local law enforcement agencies, policed these areas. In the mid-60s, South San Gabriel included both flat areas and what we called the hills, or Las Lomas. The hills were made up of tiny houses patched together by weathered wood, chicken wire, and creaking porches that buckled and swayed like a boat on an open sea. Cadavers of rusted cars filled up yellowed yards. Torn sofas, broken lamps, and threadless tires were strewn about in vacant lots. The roads turned and twisted every which way. They were dusty, curbless streets that might have served as goat trails at one time. Coming down one of the dirt roads, you could encounter chickens, wild dogs, or pigs. Some backyards held the wood and wire sheds of fighting cocks or the copper pipings of a backyard still. The hills were unseen, unvisited. Cars flew past north of here on the San Bernardino Freeway into Los Angeles, but most of the drivers never imagined such a place existed, a place you could have found in the Ozarks or the hills of Tijuana. Bruja, bruja, whispers of morning, whispers of night, children without faces tormenting with a word descending like a torrent of leaves, like the blaze of dawn, a never-ending litany. Bruja, bruja, the conspiracy of voices greets the old woman who lives in an almost toppled unpainted house next door, her backyard dense with overgrown weeds. They say she is a witch. The children hide in bushes or behind fences and taunt her as she lumbers outside to put out trash or water her grassless yard. Bruja, bruja! They sling dirt clods at her feet, tease her to tears, dare her to strike away at this cancer of childhood that makes her last days alone in this clapboard cottage feel like the hellfires she herself condemns the voices to. The old woman grabs a trash can lid or a broom and pursues the children who scamper out of the way, laughing and jeering as she creaks in her bones. One Halloween, the woman offers the neighborhood children cookies, but the talk is she made them with cyanide. Nobody eats the cookies, but soon all the cats in the neighborhood vanish and nobody knows why. One morning, uniformed men bust into the old woman's house. Sheriff's deputies pull her from out of the debris-strewn guts of the wood shingle dwelling. The women never cleaned it. They take the woman away, never to come back. It turns out she had been babysitting three small children when, for an unknown reason, the kids' parents never came back for them. The woman ran out of food. One day, trash collectors find three children in a playpen next to the morning garbage. Angry voices close in on the woman's house after her removal. A few kids throw rocks at the windows, the glass falling like raindrops skewing down a marble wall. Somebody pours gasoline on the splintered porch. Somebody tosses a twirled newspaper lid at the top. Next door, the glow washes across faces as we observe the house crackle and tumble in a craze of flames. The Mexicans who came to live in the San Gabriel Valley worked the fields, the railroads, or in the encroaching industry which soon dotted the valley. Their barrios had names like El Jardín, the garden, Monte Flores, mountain flowers, Cantaranas, singing frogs, named for the watery inhabitants of a local swamp, Bolin, a Spanish corruption of Baldwin Park, or La Puente, the bridge. Las Lomas was an old barrio whose main rivals were to the west in East Los Angeles, or the north in another barrio called Sangra. Sangra was a corruption of San Gabriel, an incorporated city built around one of the Spanish missions founded by Father Junipero Serra in the 1700s. A major Indian village, Yangna, was once situated here. Later, when the railroads linked many of the missions, they brought in Mexican laborers who became the first barrio residents. It didn't take long for middle-income Anglos, primarily fleeing LA's inner city as it filled up with people of color, to move in and around these barrios and create the first suburbs. New tracts of homes suddenly appeared on previously empty space or by displacing the barrios. In later years, large numbers of Asians from Japan, Korea, and Taiwan also moved into the area. Sections of Monterey Park and even San Gabriel became known as Little Japans or Chinatowns. It wasn't hard to find an unpaved road cluttered with shacks on one block while row stucco townhouses graced another. The barrios which weren't incorporated, including Las Lomas, became self-contained and forbidden. Incubators of rebellion, which the local media generally controlled by suburban whites, labeled havens of crime. For years, nobody ventured into Las Lomas unless they had to be there. Buses refused to provide residents there any service. Sheriff's deputies entered it with full firepower and ample backup, hardly ever alone. One of the county's most devastating increases in gang activity centered on Las Lomas. We didn't call ourselves gangs. We called ourselves clubs or clicas. In the back lot of the local elementary school, about a year after Tino's death, five of us gathered in the grass and created a club. The impersonations. The being an old English usage that other clubs would adopt because it made everything sound classier, nobler, badder. It was something to belong to, something that was ours. We weren't in Boy Scouts, in sports teams, or camping groups. The impersonations is how we wove something out of the threads of nothing. We are taking a pledge, Miguel Robles said. A pledge to be for each other. To stand up for the clica. The impersonations will never let you down. Don't ever let the impersonations down. Miguel was 11 years old like the rest of us. Dark, curly-haired, and good-looking. He was also sharp in running, baseball, and schoolwork, and a leader. Miguel was not prone to loudness or needless talking, but we knew he was the best among us. We made him president of our club. The Impersonations was born of necessity. It started one day at the school during lunch break. A few of us guys were standing around talking to some girls, girls we were beginning to see as women. They had makeup and short skirts. They had teased hair and menstruations. They grew breasts. They were no longer Yolanda, Guadalupe, or Maria. They were Yoli, Lupi, and Mari. Some of the boys were still in grass-stained jeans with knee patches that had only begun getting uncontrollable hard-ons. The girls flowered over the summer, and it looked near impossible for some of us to catch up. Older dudes from junior high school or even some who didn't go to school would come to the school and give us chilled looks as they scoped out the young women. That day, a caravan of low scraping cars slow dragged in front of the school. A crew of mean-looking vatos piled out, armed with chains, bats, metal pipes, and zip guns. "The mystics rule!" one of them yelled from the other side of the school fence. The mystics were a tough, up-and-coming group. They fired the rigged 22s at the school and broke a couple windows with stones. They rammed through the gate and front entrances. Several not-so-swift dudes who stood in their way got beat. Even teachers ran for cover. Terror filled everyone's eyes. I froze as the head stomping came dangerously my way. But I was also intrigued. I wanted this power. I wanted to be able to bring a whole school to its knees and even make teachers squirm. All my school life until then had been poised against me, telling me what to beat, what to say, how to say it. I was a broken boy, shy and fearful. I wanted what the mystics had. I wanted the power to hurt somebody. Police sirens broke the spell, dudes scattered in all directions, but the mystics had done their damage. They had left their mark on the school and on me. Miguel and the rest of us started the impersonations because we needed protection. There were other clubs popping up all over, many challenging anybody who wasn't into anything. All of a sudden, every dude had to claim a clique. Some of these clubs included the Ravens, the Superiors, Latin Legions, the Imitations, Los Santos, and Chugalug, a curious mix of Anglo and Mexican dudes. These were the Southside clubs for South San Gabriel. The biggest on the South Side then were the Illusions and their allies, the Mystics. Over in San Gabriel, other clips were formed, such as the Regents, the Chancellors, Little Gents, the Intruders, and Little Jesters. Most of the clubs began quite innocently. Maybe they were a team of guys for friendly football. Sometimes they were set up for trips to the beach or the mountains, but some became more organized. They obtained jackets with their own colors and identification cards. Later, a few of the cliques became car clubs who invested what little they had in bouncing lowriders, street-wise shorts splashed with colors, which cruised the main drags of local barrios or the main cruising spot we called the Boulevard, Whittier Boulevard, in East Los Angeles. Then also, some of the clubs metamorphosed into something more unpredictable, more encompassing, something more deadly. Junior high school became the turning point. After grammar school, I ended up going to Richard Garvey Intermediate School. My father had gotten a job as a laboratory technician at a Los Angeles community college. So we moved into a larger two-bedroom place in territory which stood between the two major barrios, Las Lomas and Sangra. This meant I had to go to Garvey. In the mid-1960s, the students at Garvey had some of the worst academic scores in the state. Most of the time, there were no pencils or paper. Books were discards from other suburban schools where the well-off students turned up. The kids who lived in the hills found their way into Garvey, and for half of them, the school was the end of the line. It had more than a 50% dropout rate among Mexicans before they even got to high school. There were only a couple of impersonations who made it there. Miguel Robles and the others ended up in another school. Garvey was illusions and mystics territory. I was on my own. Again, the first thing I noticed were some of the girls. The ones from the hills weren't just blossoming women, though. They were already hardened, sophisticated. Some of them called themselves cholas. They had long, teased hair, often peroxided black or red. They had heavy makeup, skirts which hugged their behinds, and they were all the time fighting, including with guys. The cholas laughed a lot and knew how to open up to every situation. They talked back, talked loud, and talked tough. And they knew how to dance. A few East LA people who moved into the hills brought the East LA style with them. There were federally subsidized housing projects not far from here called Maravilla. It was so named in the 1920s when Los Angeles City officials rebuilt the downtown area and got rid of the Mexicans in the inner core by offering land on the far outreaches of town for a dollar. When the Mexicans got wind of this, they exclaimed, "Qué maravilla!" What a marvel, and the name took. My first love at 12 years old was a girl from Maravilla named Elena, a chola who came to Garvey all prendida. She didn't just know how to kiss, but how to take my hand through sections of her body and teach a preteen something of his own budding sexuality. At Garvey, the dudes began to sport cholo attire, the baggy starch pants and suspenders over white t-shirts, the flannel shirts clipped only from the top button, the bandanas and small brim hats. It was hip, it was different, and it was what the cholas liked. This is what I remember of junior high. Cholas who walked up the stairs in their tight skirts, revealing everything, and looked down at us, smiling at their power. Bloody kotexes on the hallway floor, gang graffiti on every available space of wall, fires which flared from restroom trash bins, fights every day, including after school on the alley off Jackson Avenue. Dudes who sold and took drugs, mostly downers and yesca, but sometimes heroin, which a couple of dudes shot up in the boys' room while their homies kept a lookout. Yet most of the Mexican girls weren't cholas. Their families still had strong reins on many of them. Mexicans were mostly traditional and Catholic. Fathers, mothers, or older brothers would drop off these girls and come get them after school so no perceived harm would come their way. One of them was Socorro from Mexico, who was straight and proper and tried to stop me from being a cholo. I asked her to become my girlfriend when word got around she liked me and Elena had left me for Raton, a down dude from the hills. "They're trash," Socorro would often say in Spanish about the cholillos. "If you keep hanging out with them, you can say goodbye to me forever. I liked her, but we didn't last too long as a couple. I didn't want to be straight and proper. My next girlfriend was Marina, a girl from Lomas who had one of the highest peroxided teases on her head with blonde streaks that accentuated her dark face. It was at Marina's urging that I obtained my first tattoo. A dude named Angel charged $5 for an hour's work beneath the school's bleachers. They were crude, unadorned hand etchings. Angel used sewing needles sterilized by placing them over a match flame. He then tied a tight wound of sewing thread on the end. Enough of the needle's point stuck out to penetrate below the skin. Angel dipped the needle into a bottle of Black India ink, allowing the thread to soak it up. Then he punctured the skin with quick up and down motions, filling the tiny holes with ink from the thread. I got the tattoo on my upper right arm. It was an outline of a cross beneath the words, "Mi vida loca." We drove teachers nuts at Garvey. A number of them were sent home with nervous breakdowns. We went through 3 teachers and 5 substitutes in my homeroom my first year at the school. One of my teachers was a Cuban refugee named Mr. Enriquez. We made him wish he never left the island. He could hardly speak English, and when he spoke Spanish, it was a sure sign we were in trouble. Every morning, Mr. Enriquez entered the class and got bombarded with spitballs and jelly beans. Sometimes he'd turn around to write something on the chalkboard, and everyone would drop their books all at once. Often, you could find Mr. Enriquez with his head on his desk, cursing into folded arms. Then there was the science teacher, Mrs. Krieger. She must have been 80 years old or more. It took her half the class period to walk up the stairs and down the hall to her classroom. By that time, most of the class was gone. Once, as she creaked around to write something on the chalkboard, we threw her rain-stained, beat-up encyclopedias, which were as ancient as she was, out the windows. Then we threw out the desks and chairs. Before long, most of Miss Krieger's classroom was scattered across the front lawn, and she didn't realize it until a school official ran puffing up the stairs to investigate what the hell was going on. There were many good teachers, but some of the others appeared to be misfits, such as the gym instructor, who looked like a refugee from the Marines. He shouted commands even in normal conversation, was always dressed in shorts, and never failed to have a stainless steel whistle hanging from his bull neck. The shop teacher was Mr. Stone, who acted exactly as if he were carved out of a thick piece of gray granite. He dealt with us harshly, always on his guard. But one day, we broke through his defenses. The shop class was inside an old bungalow at the back of the school. The front door had Las Lomas spray painted on the outside, followed by the words Gonzafos, the Cholo term that signified nobody should mess with this if they valued their life. Mr. Stone was inside showing our class how to cut a piece of wood on a rotary saw. Then Elias, one of the batitos, started a racket from the back of the room. Mr. Stone turned around to discipline him, but he forgot to turn off the saw. It sliced away at the board, then his finger. Man, what a mess. Mr. Stone turned a sickening pale color as soon as he realized what had happened. God damn it, he yelled, God damn it, as his face wrinkled with every throb of pain. An ambulance came and rushed Mr. Stone away. School officials shoved everyone else into another classroom until they could hold meetings to determine who to blame. But Elias and I sneaked out and returned to the woodshop bungalow. The door was still open. We foraged through the piles of sawdust and wood pieces and found Mr. Stone's finger. It looked purplish with dried blood and bone chips on one end. Elias carefully placed it inside an empty cigar box. For weeks, we kept the finger in Elias' locker. He'd bring it out to scare some of the girls and to show it off to incoming students until it shriveled away like a dried sliver of old fruit. "You can't be in a fire, not get burned." This was my father's response when he heard of the trouble I was getting into at school. He was a philosopher. He didn't get angry or hit me. That he left to my mother. He had these lines, these cuts of wisdom, phrases and syllables, which swept through me, sometimes even making sense. I had to deal with him at that level, with my brains. I had to justify in words, with ideas, all my actions, no matter how insane. Most of the time, I couldn't. Mama was heat. Mama was turned around leather belts and wailing choruses of Mary, Mother Jesus. She was the penetrating emotion that came at you through her eyes, the mother guilt, the one who birthed me, who suffered through the contractions and diaper changes and all my small hurts and fears. For her, dealing with school trouble or risking my life was nothing but discourse, nothing to debate. She went through all this hell and more to have me? I'd better do what she said. Mama hated the Cholos. They reminded her of the rowdies on the border who fought all the time, talked that galo slang, drank mezcal, smoked marijuana, and left scores of women with babies bursting out of their bodies. To see me become like them made her sick, made her cringe and cry and curse. Mama reminded us how she'd seen so much alcoholism, so much weed madness, and she prohibited anything with alcohol in the house, even beer. I later learned this rage came from how Mama's father treated her siblings and her mother, how, in drunken rages, he'd hit her mom and drag her through the house by the hair. The school informed my parents I had been wreaking havoc with a number of other young boys. I was to be part of a special class of troublemakers. We would be isolated from the rest of the school population and forced to pick up trash and clean graffiti during the rest of the school year. "Mrs. Rodriguez, your son is too smart for this," the vice principal told Mama. "We think he's got a lot of potential, but his behavior is atrocious. There's no excuse. We're sad to inform you of our decision." They also told her, the next time I cut class or even made a feint toward trouble, I'd be expelled. After the phone call, my mom lay on her bed, shaking her head while sobbing in between bursts of how God had cursed her for some sin, how I was the devil incarnate, a plague, testing her in this brief tenure on earth. My dad's solution was to keep me home after school, grounded. Yeah, sure. I was 13 years old already, already tattooed, already sexually involved, already into drugs. In the middle of the night, I snuck out through the window and worked my way to the hills. At 16 years old, Ronald turned out much better than me, much better than anyone could have envisioned during the time he was a foul-faced boy in Watts. When we moved to South San Gabriel, a Mrs. Snelling took a liking to Rano. The teacher helped him skip grades to make up for the times he was pushed back in those classes with the retarded children. Mrs. Snelling saw talent in Rano, a spark of actor during the school's thespian activities. She even had him play the lead in a class play. He also showed some facility with music, and he was good in sports. He picked up the bass guitar and played for a number of garage bands. He was getting trophies in track and field events, in gymnastic meets, and later in karate tournaments. So, when I was at Garvey, he was in high school being the good kid, the Mexican exception, the Vario success story, my supposed model. Soon, he stopped being Rano or even Jose. One day, he became Joe. My brother and I were moving away from each other. Our tastes, our friends, our interests were miles apart. Yet there were a few outstanding incidents I fondly remember in relationship to my brother. Incidents which, despite their displays of closeness, failed to breach the distance which would later lie between us. When I was 9, for example, my brother was my protector. He took on all the big dudes, the bullies on corners, the ones who believed themselves better than us. Being a good fighter transformed him overnight. He was somebody who some feared, some looked up to. Then he developed skills for racing and high jumping. This led to running track, and he did well, dusting all the competition. I didn't own any talents. I was lousy in sports. I couldn't catch baseballs or footballs, and I constantly tripped when I ran or jumped. When kids picked players for basketball games, I was the last one they chose. The one time I inadvertently hit a home run during a game at school, I didn't mean to do it. I ended up crying while running around the bases because I didn't know how else to react to the cheers, the excitement directed at something I did. It just couldn't be me. But Rano had enemies too. There were two Mexican kids who were jealous of him. They were his age, 3 years older than me. One was named Eddie Gomez, the other Ricky Corral. One time, they cornered me outside the school. "Hijo says brother," Eddie said. I didn't say anything. "What's the matter? Can't talk?" "Oh, he can talk all right," Ricky chimed in. "He's acting the pendejo because his brother thinks he's so bad. Well, he ain't shit. He can't even run." "Yeah, Jose's just a lambiche, a kiss-ass," Eddie responded. "They give him those ribbons and stuff because he cheats." "That's not true," I finally answered. "My brother can beat anybody." "Oh, you saying he can beat me?" Eddie countered. "Sure sounds like he said that," Ricky added. "I'm only saying that when he wins those ribbons at Star Derecho," I said. "It sounds to me like you're saying he better than me," Eddie said. "Is that what you're saying, man?" Ricky demanded. "Come on, is that what you're saying?" I turned around and beneath my breath mumbled something about how I didn't have time to argue with them. I shouldn't have done that. "What'd you say?" Eddie said. "I think he called you a punk," Ricky agitated. "You call me a punk, man?" Eddie turned me around. I denied it. "I heard him, dude. He say you are a punk-ass puto," Ricky continued to exhort. The fist came at me so fast, I don't even recall how Eddie looked when he threw it. I found myself on the ground. Others in the school had gathered around by then. When a few saw it was me, they knew it was going to be a slaughter. I rose to my feet. My cheek had turned swollen and blue. I tried to hit Eddie, but he backed up real smooth and hit me again. Ricky egged him on. I could hear the excitement in his voice. I lay on the ground defeated. Teachers came and chased the boys out. But before Eddie and Ricky left, they yelled back, "Jose ain't nothing, man. You ain't nothing." Anger flowed through me, but also humiliation. It hurt so deep, I didn't even feel the fracture in my jaw, the displacement which would later give me a disjointed, lopsided, and protruding chin. It became my mark. Later, when I told Rano what happened, he looked at me and shook his head. "You didn't have to defend me to those dudes," he said. "They're assholes. They ain't worth it." I looked at him and told him something I never ever told him again. "I did it because I love you." Along the spine of the night, through the shrubbery, on the coarse roads, past the peeling shacks, past the walls filled with the stylized writing that proclaimed our existence, past La India shed, where boys discovered the secret of thighs in the din of whispers, past Berta's garden of herbs and midnight incantations, past the Hoppo's liquor store, past the empty lots scattered around the barrio we called the Fields, overlooking Nina's house, pretty Nina, who lavished our dreams. There, you'd find the newest and strongest clique. There, you'd find the animal tribe. We lingered in the dust, Clavo, Willo, Chicharron, and I. We walked through these streets in pairs with a rhythm slow like a bolero. I had on a t-shirt cut off at the shoulders with the animal tribe and old English lettering on the back, written in shoe polish, and a long pair of county jail pants called counties over a couple of black Tijuana sandals. Clavo, Willo, Chicharron, and I. We picked up cigarettes at La Mar-